panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
3CR 855am, 3CR digital, 3cr.org.au, 3CR on demand. Out of the Pan with Sally, first broadcasting noon through one every Sunday afternoon. Thanks for your company. 3CR broadcasts from the lands of the Kulin Nations at the overlap of the contested lands of the Wurundjeri and Bunurong peoples, and we pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. Hello to any Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander people, First Nations people tuning in from whichever land you are on today. and we acknowledge that all the lands were stolen and never ceded. Always was. Always will be Aboriginal land. I'm Sally Goldner. I use the pronouns she and her, and on Out of the Pan today, a show covering pansexual issues. Got a great guest coming up in a minute. But if you want to get in touch with the show, and I've got a feeling you'll have lots of queries, we love those on this show, to ask our guest, there's lots of ways to do it. You can email outofthepan855@gmail.com, SMS 61456751215, Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and Instagram at Sal Gold Said So. And that's the bottom line. And posts on Facebook, my page, Sally Goldner AM, and Out of the Pan 3CR 855 AM Melbourne. Postal address, PO Box 1277, Collingwood 3066. Remember, any opinions I express on the show, strictly my own. And thanks to Out of the Blue, diving deep for the marine news, as they always do, talking sustainable fishing this morning. Always lots of great information on the program. And don't think there'll be any content notes that I can think of today, but so I'll give you the numbers if and when we need them. Well, one of the things that's emerged possibly, I'd say, in about the last 10 years is the huge overlap of people, and there's lots of ways people can define themselves, whether they say they're on the autism spectrum, person with autism. Of course, that's up to each individual. And the overlap or slash intersectionality of autism with all of LGBTIQA plus communities. And I would add that having checked in with people of the experience of variation of sex characteristics, I will include intersex there. Thank you, Paul Moroney-Byrne, who is a great advocate and also is a presenter of the great intersex program over on Joy 94.9 called The Eye in Us. And so it's of great relevance that I got notified of a book a few weeks ago that I couldn't wait to talk to our guest about, and she is on the line to talk about Autistics at Work, A Practical Guide. Please welcome to the 3CR Airwaves, Sandra Tom. Sandra, welcome.
Well, thank you, Sally.
So good to sort of have you on the show because, you know, obviously I would add for starters that, of course, people of all backgrounds can be on the autism spectrum or however they want to define themselves in relation to that. But, you know, so it's a really important book. But I might start by asking you, was there a sort of light bulb moment where you decided, I want to write a book called Autistics at Work?
There were several. So the first wasn't really a light bulb moment. I was writing my first book, Growing Into Autism, which was about the experiences of being a late diagnosed autistic person and what it's like to be autistic and trying to explain that to non-autistic people. And my publisher had given me a word count, as they do, and I was very close to it. And there was still so much more I wanted to say. And I wanted to say a lot about what it was like to be in the workplace and some of the challenges we had. And then I thought, maybe that's a second book. And I kind of hinted at it in the first book. I sort of wrote somewhere in one of the footnotes. And my next book will be. and then I didn't really do anything about it until we were all going back to work post-lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And like many autistic people, I suddenly realised that for all the terrible things that happened related to lockdown,
mm-hmm.
working from home for many autistic people was a marvellous experience because so many of the challenges we were exposed to in the workplace weren't there. And I was productive, I was happy, I was calm, I was healthy for the first time in 2 decades and terrified of going back to work. And that, for me, was probably the big prompt. Why is it that my workplace isn't more like this? Why is it that going back to work is such a scary experience for an autistic person?
Yep. Yeah. Definitely so. I'm just going to be upfront with our listeners. As someone who's recently self-recognized and recently formally diagnosed, I can certainly agree. And of course, all the evidence talks to it about that. Very late diagnosed. But I suppose sticking to the point of the interview, what sort of things you know, this might sound an incredibly obvious question, but, you know, we want to also build allyship with neurotypical slash or relic people. You know, sort of what sort of things happen for people who are on the spectrum in a workplace that can create, we'll say, negative situations?
There's a whole range of things. I mean, there's physical things around the environment. So a lot of autistic people are hypersensitive to sensory things in the environment. So, you know, for me, for example, light is a huge issue.
Yep.
So I used to find when I was working in an office that the level of lighting that was suitable for my colleagues and they were all fairly comfortable with would give me massive headaches. And the amount of energy that I was using just to try and block out the lights, ignore the lights, pretend the lights weren't there, was taking so much energy, there wasn't that much left to do my work. And then when you add the energy of doing the work and the energy of dealing with the lights and the noise and the smells and everything else, mm-hmm. I was coming home from work. I would walk in the door, up the stairs and go to bed. That was my day. I didn't talk to my family. I didn't have hobbies. I just came home from work, went to sleep.
Wow.
So sensory issues are huge for many of us.
Yep.
And then all the social stuff, you know. And I think the thing that's really important is that we need to recognise, our neurotypical colleagues need to recognise, it's not that autistic ways of communicating are wrong.
Mm.
They're just different. You know, we often have different speaking patterns. We use body language differently. A lot of us have trouble with eye contact. We might not get all those unwritten social rules as quickly, things like working out how to initiate a conversation, when to stop talking, what to talk about. A lot of those things are challenging for us. Doesn't mean that we're wrong. We're just in the minority.
Yeah.
And many of your listeners know what it's like to be in a minority where you're just assumed to be wrong because your way of existing in the world is different to the majority. And that's the switch that I think that's really important. If all of our neurotypical colleagues could learn that autistic ways of communicating are not wrong, autistic ways of socialising are not wrong, they're just different. And because there's less of them than us, we just assume our ways are right, but let's actually listen to them about what they need and what works for them.
Yep. No, look, you're right on the button, you know, there, and you're totally, you know, certainly, you know, obviously LGBTIQA plus listeners, all of whom have had one or more experiences of being told our identity and or existence is wrong in some way and to some degree, certainly will understand that. I mean, there are many stories in the book. There's one that got me sort of, I don't know, it was one that just, maybe it related, maybe it just dropped my jaw on the floor. And I'm wondering if it would be okay to ask if you gave us a teaser of the book. I'm going to talk about it was a workplace experience and the sandwiches. I think you hopefully get the one I mean.
Yes, I do, yes.
Yeah, if you're okay to just share that one and the responses to it.
Yes, it is one of those things, isn't it, where there are those, I call them hidden curriculum.
Yeah.
Where there are expectations in the workplace that neurotypical people seem to get and autistic people often don't get. So the particular experience that Sally's talking about was quite early in my career and I was, you know, quite junior, well, very junior. I was the most junior person in the workplace and I would go out to get my lunch and the boss would say, you know, can you grab me a chicken sandwich while you're out?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would grab him a sandwich while I was out. And then one day he was going out for lunch and I was busy. And I said, could you grab me a sandwich while you're out? And the whole office went silent. And I got in a lot of trouble from my direct supervisor for my completely inappropriate behaviour to the extent of, you know, almost being dismissed because that was so wrong and inappropriate. And somehow I was supposed to just know that. But why?
Mm.
He was going for lunch and I was hungry and I could keep working. And we're supposed to just know that. And apparently neurotypical people would have just known that that was wrong, but I didn't.
Yeah, so it was just, we don't ask the big people higher up the hierarchy to do something and we just, you know, sort of that's accepted. Is that, you know, that's a neurotypical thing? I think I sometimes wonder, here's a, This is hopefully an objective question, but it is a personal one. Do neurodivergent people, including autism, perhaps have more, I'll say two things. One, don't recognise hierarchy as much, and two, perhaps have trouble with it, because to us, a statement's a statement regardless of where it comes from in the hierarchy. That's probably a bit loaded, but I hope you get the gist of the question.
Yes, and I think it's true, but I also, and this is where I was saying about neurotypical people saying our ways are wrong, and I actually think our ways are different, not wrong. Because I think in a lot of ways, our ways are better. Because I know part of it's not being aware of their hidden curriculum, but also part of it's because their hidden curriculum doesn't make sense to us. Because autistic people are far more likely to be egalitarian, to treat everyone as equal, to be more passionate about social justice and equity. So, you know, if I look at my experience as I continued through the workplace, I started to learn those rules, but I never really agreed with them or accepted them. And, you know, I climbed to a very senior leadership role in the organisation, but I would still go out to get my lunch and call out, does anyone need anything while I'm out? And that, to me, was still normal behaviour. I didn't get to the top of the hierarchy and suddenly think, I'm more important than everyone else, so I shouldn't buy them a sandwich. Or, you know, if we were doing a group project and we had to go... I did a sort of a marketing type health marketing role. Mm-hmm. And so we did a lot of stuff where we were, you know, doing things like putting up posters. And so I would be like, well, we've got 100 posters. Let's all put up 10 each. And I had a lot of my peers say, oh, you don't do that at your level of the organisation. That's what you have staff for. Mm. And my view was, but we're a team. Right? And so we do it together. And that's, you know, and I had a wonderful relationship with my staff, and loyalty that went very much both ways, because I don't see it that way. And that's been very much my experience with pretty much all of the neurodivergent people that I've worked with, that stuff's not as important. We don't kind of look at, well, where do you sit in a hierarchy, whether it's at work or any other situation, and say, I'm more important than you, therefore I won't help you. You know, we're much more likely to say, I'm a human, you're a human. How can we all get along together and, you know, make the world a better place for everyone?
Yeah, personally, that seems to be a nice approach. Again, trying to be objective. Everything I've said about leadership says, how can we lift other people? It seems to be everything I've heard about leadership and read says, lift other people. That's good leadership, and buying them a sandwich or sitting listening to them or whatever it is, I think that's good leadership. People on the autism spectrum, it makes sense. The thing that's really good about autistics at work, and I am talking with Sandra Tom, the author of said book, is I like the fact that you cover the whole sort of work experience in terms of, you know, career choices, job applications, job interviews, then you get into the workplace, what works, what doesn't, or the whole thing. I think that's really important. And, you know, I hope this again isn't a loaded question. How often do people, autistics think, oh, I'd like to do career X. This would be my ideal. Let's call it the blue sky thing. Let's unfortunately leave aside that stupid thing called money. But how many times do people think, oh, I can't do it because I wouldn't fit the workplace? I mean, you know, sort of, is that a common thing? And then, you know, sort of, how do we get around it?
I think that is a common thing, but I don't think that comes from us as autistic people.
Yeah.
I think that comes from everyone around us. So a very common thing is the people who advise us, whether that's well-meaning family members, whether it's career counsellors, school teachers, whoever, have those very stereotypical views of what autistic people can and can't do. And the career advice we get is that career won't be suited to you. And, you know, I've worked much of my career in universities, and, you know, I often have... lecturers in different fields will say, oh, yes, but they wouldn't be suited to nursing, or they wouldn't be suited to teaching. But they're very good in IT, you know, they're very good in accounting. So we grow up as autistic children with those assumptions being made. We hear that over and over again. You're an autistic person, so you will be good at this and you won't be good at that. So you should go there and you shouldn't go there. Or you apply for a job, and if you've admitted on your application or in some public space that you're an autistic person, there's lots of research that shows people see that and make assumptions about whether a person is suitable. And that's why one of the things that I was really keen to do in the book, and I'm glad my publisher let me do it, I don't know if you've noticed it yet, but right at the very back in Appendix 2, I have a list of successful autistic Australians in a whole range of different careers, and they're doing everything, everything. They're teachers and nurses and artists and psychologists and anthropologists, research directors, you know, writers, all sorts of things. There is no career that an autistic person can't do with the right supports and the right environment. You know, it should, we shouldn't ask that question, what can autistic people do, any more than we ask the question, what can non-autistic people do? It's what can this person do with the skills, talents and interests they've got in an environment that is suitable for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just looking at, I did sort of look at the appendices at the back, including Appendix 2, Steve Bidolf, who's written so many books about men and masculinity, was one name that came to mind, one who I know, Clem Bastow, who is a writer and is also a fan of pro wrestling. There it is. It's a running in joke on this show. There's always a pro wrestling reference somewhere in the show, and there it was at 12:21 in about 30 seconds. I'm just sort of, you know, looking for other names who are perhaps, Hannah Gadsby, well-known comedian, of course, Nanette and other great shows and great allyship supporting trans comics. I mean, there's just three at random looking through here that names that I think people would know, which I think is really good. But, you know, then looking at the occupations, social worker, chief people officer, reborn doll artist, sort of perinatal psychologist, there's four pretty random ones. I mean, that's, I think, probably reassuring for autistics to know that that's a possibility. So that's very, very important indeed. Whoops. Sorry, Sandra, are you still... So it is important to know that. The thing that I wanted to mention, you start off the book Autistics at Work talking about the preface, The Long and Winding Road, A Potted History of Your Own Search for a Career That Fits. And that's really important as well. And perhaps I think it might be worth sharing to put, the human and personal touch onto this, of course, which is so important to you. Tell us a little about that and some of the things that you've been through in relation to this.
I think I've tried just about every career that exists, really. I started out, like most people, with part-time job that you get through friends. And my first job was actually cleaning a preschool, which is in many ways a crazy job for an autistic person because the smell of chemicals cleaning up after small children. It was appalling, the bleach and it was awful.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it was I was there completely by myself, and I could listen. This was the days before we had little tiny music devices. So, I had my big tape recorder.
Couldn't carry a boombox with you, yeah.
Yeah, and I could listen to music, but I could just have the whole space to myself, and it was quiet, and it was after the torture of school. School was torturous, as it is for many autistic teenagers. And so I enjoyed that part of it. But then, I went through, I left school early like a lot of us do. I couldn't cope with the bullying at high school because if you're different, as you all know, kids figure that out and you become a very, very easy target. So I left school the day I turned 16 and left home as well. And I tried every job. I worked as a checkout operator in a grocery store, another terrible job for an autistic person. So much social contact. Bright lights, everything, all the things that weren't wrong. you know, the uniform, everything.
Mm-hmm.
I sold flowers, walking, you know, door to door in an industrial estate, trying to sell flowers to people who were, you know, panel beaters and mechanics. I worked in a food court. I worked in a bar. I think I just picked just about every job that was not suitable for somebody with sensory issues and challenges with social interaction. And I joined the public service for a while. I thought that would be really good for me because the public service has rules. And I thought, yeah, autistic person, like following rules, you know, policy processes, that'll be great.
Yeah.
But then I found that there's so much hidden curriculum in public service. And, you know, you have to do things that are morally reprehensible. I won't say what department that I was in, but I was in a department where it was part of my job to do things that I thought were inhuman and unkind and just really conflicted with my sense of social justice. So I didn't survive there very long. Went back to uni. I kept going back to uni. Didn't like the social interaction of uni, but I love learning. I love collecting facts. And then so I ended up sticking with the university career. Stayed in the university sector for 20 years until the wheels fell off because change of leadership, and ended up under a leader who was not particularly autistic friendly, and suddenly my environment was not. I went from you know, almost two decades of people understanding and accepting my autistic ways of working and creating environments and structures where I could thrive to one where I had to behave like a neurotypical, that's what's expected of you. And now I write books, I do consulting, I live a happy life where I just figure the rest of whatever time I've got, I'm just going to do things to try and make it better for the next generation so they don't have to experience the shitty parts of the workplace that I had to survive.
No, fair enough. And I like the fact that you have, out of all the, well, probably putting it mildly, trials and tribulations, found a sense of purpose as well, which I think, you know, and that leads to a question, is that, you know, I mean, people will say that we all need purpose, and I'm reluctant to use all and words like need, which are very perhaps generalised and or judgmental. But you know, regardless of diversity, people need purpose and direction. Do you think autistics need it a bit more than neurotypicals / or relic?
In my experience, yes. So I talk in the book about occasions where I've been in a job that other people would say was a good job, you know, well paid, very prestigious, and leaving because it didn't align with my values, my sense of, you know, I'm doing something that matters to me. And I see that echoed so much in so many of the autistic people that I'm friends with and that I work with, that sense of I'm doing something valuable, I'm doing something meaningful, I'm doing something that is either something that's really deeply in my area of interest or something that is changing the world for the better, or ideally both of those. Those things are really, really important to many autistic people. And for me, it's one of the really sad things about the current statistics around employment for autistic people. It's not just the fact that we're far more likely to be unemployed than people without disability, or even people with other forms of disability, mm-hmm. we're far more likely to be unemployed, but we're also far more likely to be underemployed.
Yeah.
So to be in jobs that don't use our skills, don't use our interests, because of those assumptions people make about what we can do. But if you put an autistic person in a job where they can use their interests, they can follow their passions, and they can do something that matters to them, they can change the world. They really can.
Absolutely so. There's so much to talk about in this book, and one thing that is, of course, important to this show and to much of 3CR Community Radio, which covers so many diverse groups and diverse focuses and all sorts of diverse, you know, things going beyond people, diverse forms of music. But I love the fact that in various parts of the book you've you know, got work interview questions. So you've got in one section a non-speaking autistic's perspective. You've got a non-binary autistic's perspective. You've got a BIPOC autistic's perspective. a queer Aboriginal autistic woman's perspective. So these are all really important, it may sound, some of these may sound obvious maybe to some of our listeners who, particularly queer and or autism, who would have a sense of social justice. But what are the sort of perspectives that come out for people, beyond your particular experience as well?
So that was really, really important to me when I was writing the book, because I'm very conscious that, I come from a very specific space that is in many ways very privileged. I'm white, cisgender, female, so I think of my life and I think there's so many challenges I faced as an autistic person, but I know that many of my friends have faced far greater challenges because of those intersectionalities. So one of the things that I did was to, as I was writing chapters, getting some of my friends with different life experiences to say, hey, can you read this chapter for me? Like, for example, the chapter on sensory issues or communication or, choosing clothes for work, and say, how does this work with your experience? Am I missing something? Is there something else I should say so this is sufficiently inclusive? So that was great. But then also, just getting them to reflect on their own personal experiences. Because it's, to me, it's really, really important that I don't speak for them.
Of course,
because I can't, and it worries me when people sort of say, oh, and this is what it's like for someone else. And I've been asked that many times, oh, can you just write a little bit about that? And I'm like, no, I can't, because I don't know. I haven't lived in that. So, and I think for me, one of the things that comes out very clearly is just that reflection on, so for example, if I take TC's reflection on being a BIPOC autistic person, that sort of code switching and having to not only, when you're in this environment, not only not act autistic, but not act like a person of colour either. I have to pretend to be a white neurotypical person to fit in here. But then when I go home, I'm me again, and autistic people have enough difficulty with that. We have to mask in public spaces. And for me, it's a real eye-opener to think how much harder it is when you've got to mask multiple parts of your identity, and even that in different spaces, you've got to mask different parts of your identity. So for me, having those reflections is so important, because, I learn a lot from those, and I learn a lot from my friends all the time about what their experiences are like. I want workplaces to know that. I want them to be aware that they need to understand autistic experiences, but they need to understand the diversity of those experiences, because, there is much more diversity in our community, in the autistic community, around gender and sexuality than there is in the neurotypical community.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one thought that came to mind there, it was something that I remember on Bi research from some years ago, and is probably still relevant, possibly, hopefully only to a lesser degree, is that bi people sometimes feel they have to be three different ways. They might be straight in a act heterosexual in a sort of conservative workplace. They'll go out to a so-called queer nightclub and pretend to be gay or lesbian, and then finally get to a bi support group where they can be bi. So I think many, that's just one example of where I think, just looking at it from a queer perspective, people will understand the idea of, sort of having to, pretend to be other identities. And then there's also, of course, the energy taken changing from one to the other. We can't just, it's not just like, oh, we'll flick the switch and go back to the other one now. So, very, very important that we cover that indeed. You're someone who, whether self-recognized or however, you came out later in life, and I'm really curious to find out a couple of things about that. What was that like, I suppose, is the first part. And the second part is, we hear terms like masking, which I'll get you to explain, but for someone who's come out later, how do we know what mask we've got on? What do we know what it's looked like so we can take it off and do things that perhaps, where we can, work more authentically and effectively for us? Because this seems to be an issue. The longer we've gone on, we're running on a false neurotypical slash or relic autopilot. How do we know how that's wired?
Those are two huge questions, and I'm glad you asked both of them. So I guess for me, this is why I wrote my first book, Growing Into Autism, because that's what it's actually about, exactly that, that process of unmasking and actually like figuring out who the heck you are. So I, obviously, being the age that I am, secret just between you and I, Sally, I'm 59. So I grew up at a time when, you know, little girls didn't get diagnosed as autistic. So I was just weird. I was just different, and different was wrong, and constantly being told by my parents, my teachers, my peers, don't do that, that's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say that, that's weird. Don't be like that, that's weird. And I, like many autistic people, internalised that and just went through life thinking, I'm not good enough. There's something fundamentally wrong with me.
Yeah.
So I just have to hide all those bits and be more like everybody else. And then I had two children, two amazing, brilliant, wonderful children who were diagnosed as autistic. And all the things that the teachers would say to me, oh, this is a problem with your son, like, you know, every lunchtime your son goes and sits in the library and we're worried about him. And I would say, but I was going to sit in the library when I was at school. That's what I did at lunchtime. Or, you know, when the school rang me and they said, oh, you know, we suggested to your son that he might want to bring one of the other kids home after school to play with. And he was quite shocked about it and said, why would I want to take one of them home? I've had to put up with them all day. And I said, well, I can understand that, because if you suggested to me that I'd bring one of my colleagues home after work, I'd be horrified. And, you know, I started to realise that there's some similarities between me and my kids.
Yeah.
So I self-identified for a long time before I went and got a formal diagnosis. And I think for me, the diagnosis was, I didn't think it would make a big difference. I thought, okay, I've self-identified for a long time. I know I'm autistic. My kids know I'm autistic. My husband knows I'm autistic. Do I need a diagnosis? And then I was doing a fair bit of advocacy work, so I thought, maybe I need a diagnosis in case someone says, well, you're not really autistic. You're just weird. But I was going through a real crisis at that stage, and it goes back to what you were saying about masking. I thought that I was worried about getting old, because I kept saying to my husband, there's something missing from my life, you know, like I haven't done enough, like I'm getting old and I'm really scared of getting old, and I couldn't work out what it was I hadn't done. You know, I had a house, I had a car, I had a good job, great kids, great husband. And I got the diagnosis and started seeing a psychologist and having counselling and started to unpack masking and had this massive revelation that what was missing was me, right? I had no idea who I was. I didn't know what I liked. I didn't know what I was interested in. I didn't know what clothes I liked to wear. I didn't know what I liked to do with my time, because I had spent so many years pretending to be this neurotypical person and doing all the things that were expected of this neurotypical person that I didn't know how I naturally was or wanted to be. I didn't know what made me feel happy. I didn't know how I felt relaxed, how I felt calm. And the process of figuring that out took a long time, and unmasking is a really complex process. And I'm guessing you're probably right at the very beginning of that.
Yeah. Well, very... And sorry, keep going.
It does take a long time, and most people I know who go through it, you go through it in baby steps, because firstly you have to work out what it is that you're doing, and there's also that nervousness that what if people start to see the real me underneath. I think one of the things that was really helpful for me, I actually disclosed unintentionally. So what happened was I was really annoyed about something that happened one day, and I wrote an opinion piece for the Sydney Morning Herald, and they agreed to publish it. And I thought, oh no, everyone's going to read this, including my boss and everyone at work. So I better tell people before the paper comes out tomorrow. it was a fairly public event. But the thing that for me, I guess, was mostly good was everyone said, oh, yeah, we knew that. And it was like a total absence of surprise. So that was kind of good. But the unmasking process was slow. You know, I started to do things like figuring out, you know, I had a wonderful psychologist who said, well, okay, so you don't actually know exactly what it is about work that makes you feel uncomfortable. Let's talk about what spaces at work do you feel comfortable, what spaces do you feel uncomfortable. Let's write down what's different about those spaces. What happens when you're at home by yourself and there's no one there? Husband's out, kids are out, everyone's out, you're by yourself. What do you do? Like, do you make noises? Do you sing? Do you move? Do you know what I mean? And, like, really trying to explore what I would do if I had. And, yeah, it's taken me a long time. I am such a different person to the person I was before my formal diagnosis, before my disclosure. I don't feel, you know, 10 years ago I was worried about getting old and I felt like my life was going. Now I feel like I'm 21 again and I'm happy and my life is full of things that I love. My environment is full of things that I love. My life is perfect. I wouldn't change anything. It's very different and I'm very different, but I'm very happy.
That is very, very awesome to hear, Sandra. And from this, well, 60 years and 10 days old, recently diagnosed and recognised person, thank you. That's, I'm just going to say personally, you know, that's lifted, that's made my day. Thank you personally. I, as I said earlier, it was going to be very hard to keep personal and, you know, we'll say objective questions apart in this interview and, well, that's, I think it's brought them together really well. Anything else that you wanted to talk about, Autistics at Work and or your first book? And also, I suppose the question is, in the words of a 1980s or 90s advertising campaign, where do you get it? Where do we buy Autistics at Work? How do we purchase it?
Okay, so Autistics at Work and Growing into Autism. So both books you can buy from most bookshops, so, you know, Reading, Stimmix, I think Cubidoo Books now have it. Most of the independent bookstores, if they don't have it on the shelf, they will order it in. You can also get it online, you know, the usual online spaces, yep. Amazon, The Nile, all those places. Go to your local bookshops and say, if they don't have it on the shelf, why don't you have it on the shelf? It should be on the shelf. They should both be on the shelf right there at the front where everyone could see them.
yeah, so, agreed.
I would love to see them not just in the hands of autistic readers but also in the hands of their employers. I was very conscious with both books about the dual audiences. You know, Growing into Autism was written for autistic people but also for the people around them to better understand them. And Autistics at Work was written for autistic people in the workplace or planning to enter the workplace, but also for their employers and their colleagues and their organisations to understand what they could do to make workplaces more inclusive.
Yep. Definitely so. Well, yeah, it's sort of, I think LGBTIQA plus people will relate to the concept of allyship. You know, we need, you know, non-autistic / or relic allies to, you know, play their part to make sure that we are all included. And that is, of course, so much needed. Once again, just any other last thoughts you'd like to cover? Because I think I just feel like we've got it. Well, when I say we've got it, we've covered the book. We haven't got all the problems solved, but at least we know about this wonderful book.
I think the other thing that I would say, and, you know, it would be similar to any other marginalised community, is, you know, we hear a lot of stuff about the adjustments that we need in the workplace for autistic people, and we do. You know, there's a lot of physical adjustments and things that would be great, like adjustments to the sensory environment, adjustments to, you know, work roles and being able to work from home, all those things. But the biggest adjustment for autistic people would be better awareness and understanding in the workplace, really addressing some of those attitudes and misperceptions and stereotypes. If we could get to the point where people welcomed autistic people in the workplace with an open mind and actually a bit of curiosity and wanted to know what are your strengths as well as what are your challenges, and not just assume you're different to me, therefore you're wrong and you should just stop being you. You know, I think the world will be a better place, not just for autistic people, but for everyone.
Hear, hear. Sandra, I think we can leave it there. Sandra, Tom, thank you so much for your time on the show today and taking the time out to have such a big chat with us. It's been awesome. Keep in touch with the show. If there's launches or you do more books or you've got events, please let us know. We'd love to support you and 3CR with shows that cover things in the autism area, such as The Boldness. I'm sure we'd love to hear all about it. It's just been awesome talking to you. Have a great Sunday afternoon. I'll get you to hang on just while I go to some music and we'll talk off air. Thanks heaps.
Thanks, Ellie.
Sandra Tom on 3CR, and what an absolute pleasure to have Sandra on the show. That was amazing and uplifting and heartening. Well, whoever you are who you are, and yours is yours. Here's a track from Sin on 3CR, 855 AM, 3CR Digital, 3cr.org.au, 3CR On Demand, Out of the Pan with Sandra.
Finding it thought I was much more to you. My mistake, my flaw, my mistake, my retake, my heartache. My escape, double take, that we make a fake. My flow, my downfall. Notice me. fucking losers already been lost before. Still once I fucking loud and loud at your door. Finding me, finding you thought it was much more to you. My mistake, my downfall.
Eight five five AM, 3CR Digital, 3CR.org.au, 3CR on demand. Out of the pan with Sally. Just got some quick messages, and then we'll wrap up this program.
The LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Fair Day will be held in the city of Whittlesea this year. Funded by Whittlesea City Council and auspiced by Australian LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Multifaith Council, the fair will have a strong human rights social justice focus as experienced through an intersectional lens. The event is held in a safe, supportive, inclusive space consisting of art and skills-based workshops by Street Art Doyle Blender Studio, African drumming, recycled fashion and sustainable gardening, information stalls, food and giveaways. The LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Fair Day, Saturday, November 8th, 3:30 till 7:30pm at the Barry Road Community Activity Centre, 36 Barry Road, Thomastown. On-site parking available, entry is free and all are welcome. Whittlesea City Council is a 3CR supporter.
Pride Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender-attracted people, including bi, pan, regardless of label, or no label at all. We organise community events and advocate for better policies and services. I Plus Pride runs discussion groups which offer a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. I Plus Pride is especially keen to hear from multi-gender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to I Plus Pride are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at biplusprideVic.org.au, email info@biplusprideVic.org.au, or find us on Facebook or Instagram.
A 3CR supporter.
I'm bisexual.
Out of the Pan thanks Go Kindly for their sponsorship of this program. Go Kindly creates high-quality, locally-made bedding, donating 50% of profits to support women and gender-diverse people experiencing housing stress. Check out gokindly.com.au and take their pillow quiz.
Absolutely. Thank you to Go Kindly for supporting Out of the Pan, a show covering pansexual issues on 3CR 855 AM, 3CR Digital, 3CR.org.au, 3CR On Demand. Just about out of time, and there was an issue that has broken in the last few days that needs coverage, but I also have to be honest, I need to digest it, and that's the podcast series put out by the Equality Project / Better Together, where two cisgender men are discussing issues affecting women, such as so-called women's spaces and trans, and how we should compromise. Right, I think is the response to that. Under the banner of Brave Conversations, and Drummond Street Services have intervened or raised this issue. And rightly so, but I just do not have enough time to cover it today with Give It Justice. Very quickly, coming up next is Freedom of Species, and today's show will cover the issue of a media representation. Representations of vegan and animal rights in the TV show Poker Face, always covering a great range of issues, the great crew from Freedom of Species. Don't forget the Fair Day coming up very, very soon. As well, and the discussion group is on this Tuesday night, 7:15 for 7:30 Australian Eastern. And something that won't be happening next week is a new version of this show. I'm having a week off. It's all getting a bit much. But I just need a breather and I'll give myself a long weekend. That's this plan at this stage. Plans, that favourite word. So I'll be back with a new show in 2 weeks. And remember to say nup to the cup if you are concerned about animals. Take it out today with some of a track by Richard Clapton, and this track, which is one of his old ones, was redone in the 80s with just the piano backing here, and the track is in line sort of with what Sandra is saying, which gives hope for those who perhaps have come out battling with things older, including coming out as autism and or ADHD, and it's the best years of our lives. Thanks for tuning in to Out of the Pan. I'm Sally Goldner. Catch you next week.
All the lines are down, it's a steady day again. Every time the wheel slows down, I think of all my friends. Whatever happened to the days way back when the world was safe and seemed worth saving? I'm standing here in Oxford Street. Ghosts are howling, and geez, it's raining. I say, don't waste time. These are the best years of our life. I say, don't waste time. These are the best years. I wish I had been around when the Bondi icebergs rained. Sometimes I sit and think of it, and I dreamed of better days. Whatever happened the days way back in the 1930s, all those endless parties, I'm still too young to understand how it was back then, and the party, yeah. I say, don't waste time. These are the best years of our life. I say, don't waste time. These are the best.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.